You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to episode 114, I think it is, of Atheistically Speaking with your host, Thomas Smith, and with a special guest. You may know him as Bangs Naughty Bits, Michael. How you doing?
Hi, everybody.
Michael's returning to the show. You've been on at least once on the prime time here. I think we've done a bonus content, maybe twice on the main show. I'm trying to think.
But you had me on for the inaugural Meet a Patreon.
Oh, yes. Yes. That was awesome. Oh, I actually was meaning to put a post out there. Oh, maybe I'll just announce it. I want to have a Patron of the Week next week. I want to get that going again. So feel free to message me on Patreon if you want to volunteer. If not, I will try to track more people down. Okay. When last we spoke on here, Michael, we were discussing freedom of speech. And it was so, we had so much to say that I'm pretty sure we didn't even get to a lot of what we were meaning to talk about.
It's always like that, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. And it's a really important and murky issue. Like it's not very straightforward. I don't think I could talk that long about, say, like gay marriage, because it's just like, I believe that should be right. It's pretty obvious. You know, that's more straightforward to me. We could, maybe if we found someone, or if I found someone who disagreed, you know, maybe there'd be some conversation. But I don't know. At a certain point, that one's pretty easy. Whereas free speech, to me, there's so much going on because I think there are very real concerns. And even when we agree, which I think you and I agree on a lot, I think that that I may have some different ideas on some stuff, or you may have some different ideas on some stuff. It's very interesting, controversial, I think, and important.
It's always like that when two people's rights intersect in a way that's not helpful to one of them.
Right. That's very well put. So you sent me, we've been going back and forth, and then you sent me an article on reason.com, which I found to be very excellent. I think it put things in a way that I agreed with, but I didn't realize I just hadn't thought about it. And I think I'm going to just read the article. I do that sometimes on this show. I can't think of a better way. There's a lot here, so I was going to try to summarize it, but there wouldn't be much summary going on. It would pretty much be just leaving out a couple words. So I figured rather than do that, I'll just read it. If that's okay with you, if you have anything to say ahead of time.
No, I think we're all set.
All right. Well, this was on February 18th, so 1 week ago, and it's by Brendan O'Neill. So it's called After Copenhagen, The Myth of the Civilized Censorship. The two recent acts of censorship by murder in Europe, first at the offices of Charlie Hebdo in Paris, and then at a free speech debate in Copenhagen, have put the continent's political classes in a pickle. For as much as European rulers want to and do condemn the brutal actions of these Quran-thumping offense takers, the fact is they also share something in common with them, a devotion to shushing and sometimes punishing those who offend people's sensibilities. Oh, and Michael, if you want to stop me at any time, I am totally okay with kind of inserting discussion in between paragraphs or something, so let me know.
All right.
There's only so much distance the elites of Europe can make between themselves and these cartoonist-loathing shooters. So this is already pretty controversial, just to make sure everyone's on the same page. The author is kind of pointing, or at least he's about to point out, a connection that may be an uncomfortable one between what he's called the elites of Europe and the actual shooters in the cases of Charlie Hebdo and the Copenhagen shooting. So
it's a mighty broad brush, but yeah. There it is.
So we'll see. Let's see what his thesis is here and how he goes into it. For while our elites might not summarily execute people for the crime of being offensive, they do arrest them and put them on trial and occasionally jail them, all of which are acts tinged with menace, underpinned by the threat of violence, where it's understood by all that if any of these offense givers were to dodge arrest or jump jail, they could be restrained by force. It isn't only Islamo-censors who use violence to silence. All censorship, by its nature, is violent. That's a very interesting point. You could write that off as kind of rhetoric, you know, like, oh, any censorship is violent. But I think he actually has a pretty good point, because imagine for a minute, just if let's say Islamic law, you know, Sharia law or blasphemy laws, if they were universal and no one broke them, they would still essentially be violent, because there's always the threat that if someone breaks them, violence could happen. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a great deal of sense. And it has two prongs. You're censoring what someone is allowed to say, what you're allowed to say, and you're censoring what someone's allowed to listen to,
right,
what you're allowed to listen to.
Right, exactly. And he's right. I mean, if you did try to dodge it, it may not be violence so much as force, I guess. I mean, it could turn into violence, but there's not too much of a distinction there. I think there may be some tiny moral ground on which you could say, well, one form of censorship, you know, wouldn't decapitate someone, I guess. But still, I mean, that's you're grasping at straws there. I think he has a good point. Did I read this already? The awkward fact of the shared outlook. Crap, did I read that? I don't remember.
No.
The awkward fact of a shared outlook between the opinion-forming set and the killers of cartoonists surfaced once again following the shoot-up of a debate about Islam and free speech in Copenhagen at the weekend. I'm taking for granted that everyone has heard about that by now. I'm hoping it's not news. The smoke from the gunfire had barely disappeared before cagey columnists were saying that if we don't want to get killed, then we should stop offending people. A writer for The Guardian, which is linked, said Copenhagen should remind us of the obligations, quote, obligations upon those who wish to live in a peaceful, reasonably harmonious societies, end quote. Primarily the obligation to, quote, guard against the understandable temptation to be provocative, end quote, especially by publishing Muhammad-mocking cartoons. Shorter version, to avoid being shot, zip your lip. The Guardian writer is effectively doing the shooter's dirty work for him, spelling out in words what the shooter said with bullets. If you offend, you might die, so don't do it. Another Guardian columnist said the peoples of Scandinavia should now step back from their principles. That was a quote. Their, quote, strong belief in moral imperative of free speech and show more of the pragmatism for which Denmark is also famous, end quote. So, in short, Denmark and its neighbor nations should do what the shooter wanted them to do, ditch that pesky principle of free speech, that old right to provoke, and instead erm and awe before saying or showing anything edgy. So interesting. So this, just to make sure for anyone who tuned out, he's now referencing a couple of Guardian articles, two different columnists, I believe, who said that the response to these shootings should essentially be to make sure we don't piss anybody off, and offend anybody too badly. And it's interesting because they made this appeal, like, sure, Denmark is known for free speech, but also for practicality and pragmatism. So maybe use that side of it. So that's interesting there. These responses to Copenhagen, this effective aiding and abetting of the shooter's profoundly illiberal message by the supposedly liberal commentariat, echo some of the grislier responses to the Charlie Hebdo massacre. There was the infamous Financial Times column that slammed the editorial foolishness of Charlie Hebdo. Apparently, the cartoonists brought their murders upon themselves. And the New Statesman screed against free speech fundamentalists who stupidly say "Je suis Charlie" when the fact is we all know there are free speech lines that cannot be crossed. It sounded almost like a threat, an echo of the sentiments of the Charlie Hebdo killer themselves. Cross the line and you'll regret it. So twice now, the great and the good have condemned the actions of offense-killing gunmen, while at the same time embracing and spreading the moral message behind these actions. The idea that there's a line that shouldn't be crossed, that things shouldn't be said, and principles that should now be ditched. In essence, liberal observers have made themselves willing participants in acts of terror, behaving as the propagandistic spokespeople, or at least as media echoers, for the misanthropic, intolerant, censorious killers. I think I want to pause now just because I don't mind breaking up my, you know, monotonous reading and say this could be where you and I may disagree, or at least I know that I have an opinion here that I people might not agree with. I think there are some people who are very quick to call any criticism of Charlie Hebdo's cartoons victim blaming. And I want to just make sure that we're not dogmatic in that, despite the fact that I firmly believe, I'll say now, just in case anyone doubts this, I mean, I firmly believe that obviously the people who shoot people for words are completely 100% wrong. But then full stop, separate issue, you can talk about the content of the cartoons and whether or not you agree with it. I mean, imagine if there were cartoons that said, you know, horribly racist thing. I'm not saying they were, but imagine they were cartoons that were just awfully racist or homophobic things. You could still say, well, I don't like those articles, but the killers were wrong to shoot them for them. I mean, what do you think about that, Michael?
It's not that, because at that point, we're talking about them. They're still talking to us. It's a separate thing. We haven't shut them down. Okay. What the article's trying to get across, from what I see, is it's a continuum from death to state-sponsored violence or force of some sort to social force to society taking a larger view and discussing the matter. And along that continuum, there comes a point you're no longer talking about the subjects in question.
Okay.
And that's where I see the difference being.
Okay. I think I understand what you're saying. So it's more like, as long as you're discussing them with the mindset that they're open for discussion versus saying they shouldn't be saying any of that at all, no matter what. Like, is that what you mean, or do I understand?
Once it's no longer open for debate, it's a question of how closed is the debate? Is it a fine? Is it pressure from the government? Is it somebody with a large knife or an axe coming into your home?
Right.
You know, that's a wide berth that we're glossing over there. And the article glosses over that pressure. But the point is, it's the same instinct on a continuum.
Okay. Well, I just want to make sure that that we're on the same page with the point I'm trying to make. Because I remember when I said, originally talked about Charlie Hebdo, and I said there are some people who think the cartoons might have been a little racist. I did have people say, like, whoa, you're blaming the victims, blah, blah, blah. And that's not at all what I meant. I mean, we could totally – like, imagine none of the shooting had happened. We could talk about the content of Charlie Hebdo and, like, oh, maybe this – just – or replace a hypothetical cartoon. You know, we could talk about X cartoon and say, is this racist, as a separate issue of whether or not someone deserved to be killed for a potentially racist cartoon. And I think
political cartoons take advantage of – stereotypical attributes
that may
so
all be
they
fine.
Are racist to a certain extent.
Sure. And again, that's as long as my point's clear, like, then we're talking about the question. Maybe the answer to the question is no, they're not racist. Or like you said, maybe they're utilizing certain, you know, stereotypes or whatever. Maybe that's the answer to the question. But all I want to say is, merely bringing up the question had some people commenting to me that I was victim blaming. And I think that's a misunderstanding. Would you agree? Do you think I made that point right, or do you still?
No, I agree with that point. I have very little truck with people who claim victim blaming in all circumstances.
Okay, understood. So just wanted to make that little point because it was pretty relevant to that section. Now, I wasn't saying I think we're on the same page there. So I'll continue. These creepy commonalities between small gangs of killers and whole layers of respectable society reveal that these attacks may not be as alien to our way of life as some would have us believe. In fact, the two shooting sprees can be seen as simply a bloodier expression of something that's now depressingly mainstream in Europe, the idea that it's bad to give offense, so bad that you can be punished for doing it. The massacre at Charlie Hebdo and the shooting in Denmark didn't happen in a vacuum. They happened at a time and on a continent where offensiveness is actually a punishable offense. So in France, in the 6 weeks since the Charlie Hebdo massacre, far-right ideologues have been arrested for the crime of anti-Semitic speech, and three people who wrote homophobic tweets have been convicted of committing a hate crime. In Copenhagen, just 4 months ago, an art exhibition was canceled on the basis that it was racist. The Danish Penal Code forbids any speech that threatens or simply insults or degrades a group on the basis of its race, ethnic origin, sexual orientation, or faith. Was it the Quran that gave the Copenhagen cafe shooter the idea that any slur against his faith was an intolerable crime? Or was it the insult-punishing law of the land in which he was born and brought up? His own nation sent him the message that anyone who degraded his faith deserved to be punished. Very interesting. So this is where, because I mentioned it before, I pretty much see any sort of hate speech law as problematic. And I think this article will go on to make the point, drive the point home. But I just wanted to intro it by saying I think I mentioned this when I said I don't believe someone should be in prison for Holocaust denial. I mean, I think that's – I can't remember who originally brought that to my attention, but it might have been like Sam Harris or somebody. Or, no, sorry. Michael.
Hitchens.
Yeah, thank you. That was in the Hitchens speech.
Toronto
yeah.
speech.
And I remember watching that at the time and thinking that's a great point. I mean, it's – as you've said, and I think is very important, you know, the easy speech doesn't need protection, you know. Hello, how's your day going? You know, that doesn't need protection. Like, it's stuff that we might be uncomfortable with that really needs protection. And I'll just go ahead and continue, and we should be finished pretty soon. Then we can unleash all our thoughts. Across Europe, a glut of hate speech laws now control what people can say and write. Over the past 30 years, everywhere from Britain to France to Finland, laws have been passed forbidding the insulting or ridiculing of religious folk, women, ethnic minorities, gays, and others. These laws don't only punish those who shout the word nigger or faggot, which would be bad enough. They punish people for their actual moral and political convictions. Like the Swedish pastor given a one-month suspended prison sentence for expressing his belief that homosexuality is a tumor on society, or Brigitte Bardot arrested and fined five times in France for describing Islam as barbaric, or the novelist Michael Hollenbeck, I think, dragged to court in France for describing Islam as the stupidest religion. Wow. Just saying that, huh? That's pretty crazy.
Oh, I agree. I would not agree with him. There are many stupider
yeah,
religions.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. So you're right. He should go to prison. No, I'm just on the far or the far right British politician given a suspended 8-month prison sentence for expressing his disdain for Britain's immigration policy and using the word darky to describe foreigners, or the Swedish artist sent to jail for 6 months for producing paintings that mocked black people. It's the return of the mindset of the Inquisition, the old rotten idea that those who offend orthodoxies, in this case PC, may be punished, sometimes severely. Maybe the Charlie Hebdo and Copenhagen killers were mind-warped by the online ravings of some extremist finger-wagging imam from the Middle East, or maybe they imbibed the thinking of their own societies, of the laws in France and Denmark, which remove the liberties of those who insult Muslims and other groups and turns these insulters into criminals, outcasts, moral lepers. These killers can be seen not so much as an invading foreign strain of intolerant Islamism, but as the militant enforcers of the now mainstream European creed of offense avoidance and criminalization of hate and ridicule. Some will say, but our censorship is more civilized than theirs. We don't kill, we just arrest and fine or imprison those who misspeak or misthink. Please, what underpins the state's ability to criminalize and in some cases incarcerate those who give offense? Force does. Violence does. It's the knowledge that anyone who refused to pay his fine or serve his prison sentence for the crime of saying what he thinks would be made to do so by the enforcers of the state's will. Censorship is inherently threatening. It is never civilized. In fact, it's the antithesis of civilization, for it calls into question the ability of the public to judge for itself which ideas are good and which are bad, and it elevates with menace tiny cliques of people into the arbiters of what may be thought and said. Final paragraph, to rebuild freedom in Europe, it isn't enough to condemn the actions. Oh, wow. I added the two, but they actually, there's a typo there. It isn't enough to condemn the actions of small groups of gunmen. We must also dismantle, piece by piece, the vast legal structures and censorious culture that empowers the offense takers, making them believe that they have the right to silence and punish those who criticize them, and to live in a safe space, an antisocial bubble, in which a cross word is never uttered. Let's invade their safe space. Let's burst their bubble. Let's challenge the idea that words of any kind, be they gratuitously offensive or just morally dubious, should be in the business of either the state, shouldn't... Oh, sorry. They're challenging the idea it should be in the business of either the state or Islamo-murderers. Man, I got so close to the end and then messed up that sentence.
So, that's so how many chapters of the Bible is that equal to?
let's see. Let me estimate here. I would say that's they vary so much, but an average one, I'll say that's two on average, maybe.
Could something be out of the roof, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. But the Bible, I feel more I can give myself breaks by stopping and ranting. So whereas here, I didn't want to do that too much because I figured we'd lose the storyline. yeah, so fertile area for discussion, because you could look at this and on the surface, you could kind of write this guy off as like, oh, another anti-PC free speech fundamentalist. And this is where we may disagree, Michael. I feel like calling you Bangs.
I answer to almost everything.
this is where we could disagree, because I do think there is such a thing as kind of an annoying free speech activist who sort of... What I think of as the negative quality of free speech warriors in a derogatory sense, not in a good sense. There's a very good sense of that, but there's a derogatory sense where they bring it up at the wrong time. Basically, when they, you know, at inappropriate times, they think we ought to let someone, we ought to support someone when they're really just mean the government shouldn't be limiting their speech. But I don't know. That's just me.
At a funeral, perhaps.
Well, no, I mean, the people I think of who kind of honestly I get annoyed with sometimes online are the people who are defending, like, how dare you, let's say, how dare Fox News, or no, not, that would be a bad example. How dare, you know, NBC or somebody fire someone for something they said that was racist, like free speech, you know, or something like that. Personally, I think that that doesn't fall under free speech. I think that falls under a, you know, a corporation can decide that they want someone on the air or not, you know, based on what they say.
Right. We're talking two separate things. One is a state-powered institution, and the other is the institution in a private or corporate manner.
Right. Yeah.
So all of this under the envelope of the social contract that we live under.
Right. And I know that that line does get interesting. I mean, I think the last time we talked about this, it seemed like you were more on the side of there's such a thing as socially limiting free speech too much via, you know, criticism or something. I don't know. Maybe I'm remembering wrong, but I do seem to think we had a bit of a disagreement there. Does that am I recalling correctly, or
you're recalling correctly? Okay. I probably fall on that side of the line that you're more comfortable following on the other. I would not doubt that.
Well, I just think things like you know, for example, the hypothetical example of a news anchor spouting some, you know, racist nonsense on when he's not on the job, like that sort of thing. I'm okay with a company, you know, ditching them because they want to maintain their image. That's almost their free speech, you know, right.
And it's usually written in a morals clause or something like the contract that they hire him under.
And I'm okay with publicly using your own – lots of people using their free speech to make fun of people who have horribly racist or homophobic ideas. I don't support government, any sort of government censorship. I don't support any sort of state sponsored. That's where I draw a hard line. Like I don't support that at all. But I think socially there are some things that we can render completely useless to say. Now they can still be said, hypothetically be said, of course, but we can make them make the people who say them regret it socially with their reputation. I don't know. Do you think that's a step too far, or are we talking too general?
For example, the Duck Dynasty people from A&E. And
I was thinking that too.
That's good, because I'm about to say you have no right to head down that road, because they were expressing their constitutionally protected First Amendment views on religion. And I want you to tell me that you think a company has the right to censor somebody based on their religious views.
You know,
I just want to hear you say that.
Here's the thing. It sounded like I was going the other way, but when I think of that example, I'm actually surprised that A&E would ditch them for that. Because
they ditched them for a week or two.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That's true. They did. I guess it didn't end up. It's such a moneymaker. Like, they're obviously not going to lose it. But I actually didn't really support that one, because, and I can't remember which of my 70 podcasts I talked about it on. Might have been one of my comedy related ones, because I thought that it's just so obvious that they would have that point of view that, like, why would this be news to A&E? I mean, they know that that's their religious view. They know that, you know, that's probably the religious view of most of their viewers that watch Duck Dynasty. Like, it just seemed odd to me, an odd face-saving thing. I guess maybe this is a more general legal question, but where can you draw the line with your sincerely held religious belief? Do you see that as a clean line? Because, I mean, obviously there are things that we've accepted as a society that don't count. Like, you can't just, oh, it's my sincere religious belief that I need to murder my kid. You know, like, there's certain things where you can't accept it, but is that not a big deal? What do you think?
Well, what if it was a sincerely held belief, religious or merely a political belief, that gay marriage is a good thing, an equitable thing, and should be supported? Can they be fired for supporting that view, which is politically incorrect today? 10 years ago, not so much.
If
we switch the narrative.
Sure.
If we're talking about...
Oh, I follow you now. Yeah. Sorry. I thought you switched the thing, but I think I switched it in my mind. So yes. Yeah. That would have been not so politically correct. Yeah. 10, 20 years ago. Definitely.
If we were talking 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, integration, race relations, if somebody held a belief that we currently consider perfectly PC, perfectly correct today, that many years ago, people were fired for holding those beliefs.
Now,
you can't have it both ways.
Right. I agree. And I think this was a big part of my disagreement that I was not sure. I'm not totally sure on, but this is why it's such a tough issue with the CogDis folks, you know, Tom and Cecil. I think this was, I may be blending these conversations, because for them, they seem to think that it's no matter what, it's your right to fire someone for any reason at any time.
They're good libertarians. So that's all I can say.
I wonder if they would bristle at that description.
I hope so.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I think it has to do with contracts more than anything. I mean, I think the specifics of the contract you sign, let me know if you disagree with this, but I mean, if contracts are structured with A&E, for example, Duck Dynasty, that, you know, if you want to say that you'll never say anything publicly that could be construed as hateful toward any group, I mean, if you sign that contract, I think it's a different story, right? I mean, can almost anything be negated by a contractual agreement when we're talking about free speech rights?
Legal rights up to a certain point can, in fact, be abrogated. You can sign them away to a certain extent. So okay. I'm okay with that. I understand what you're saying.
But is it if let's say just hypothetically with A&E example, Is that, do you think some vague or nonspecific morals clause, you're saying you don't think that cuts it in that situation?
I'm saying
I don't want to put words
we are just, yeah, putting under the morals clause what is a fairly literal and not particularly disruptive view of somebody's religion. That's not in certain evangelical circles a complicated or nuanced view of the religion. That's the literal reading of the book as their
well, that's what they say it is, but there's nothing in the Bible about marriage. But yes, I know. I think I agree with your point. Interesting. Yeah, I wonder if people disagree with us on that, because I actually did think that one was a little odd. Whereas if they just spout some hateful nonsense, what about that? Let me ask you this hypothetical. So I believe the comments were more just not supporting gay marriage, right? Or did they go in – now, had they gone into horribly foul homophobic language, what about – what then? I mean, it's technically probably still their belief, for example, that all those, you know, faggots are going to burn in hell or something. Like if they start spouting more hate-filled language like that, do you believe that A&E can cut them for that?
It's an interesting question because you're trying to find where that line is.
Yeah.
One side of the line is protected. One side of the line isn't. And it varies over time. It varies in the circumstances where somebody will fall down on that line. And I tend to push farther into that veil of protected speech than many people do. But every time that I see somebody say, that's too far, that is a step too far, that is a mile too far, if you flip the context, suddenly you're having what we're considering to be perfectly acceptable things today. In 10 years, maybe they won't be as acceptable. And then your views are on the wrong side of that line. And I just get very nervous when somebody starts enforcing their views on another person's life because of their closely held beliefs.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's something that I think could be dealt with a certain way. I mean, maybe if it's so hard because it's all about PR. I mean, nothing has anything to do with anything with these companies like A&E or whatever news. When we're talking that situation, nothing has anything to do with anything except their image. That's all it is.
You're bringing disrepute onto their image. Yeah. You're costing them money. You're costing us money.
Well, and they're costing them, public opinion when they don't do something like fine them or, that's what they're worried about. I guarantee you these people don't give a shit. They're worried about, okay, if we don't, if we don't suspend these, people who obviously have this, who spoiler alert, don't support gay marriage. I don't know how that was a surprise. But if we don't suspend them, what are people going to think? That's all they're operating on. It sucks that that's what it is. I wish it were some more noble thing like, oh, I'm going to try to, make my free speech, make my speech heard by this act that I'm doing with my employee. But I guarantee you it's – and the evidence of that is the fact that they let him back and started making money again and everything was happy.
I want to point out though that we are drawing that line where a solid 30-40% of the United States population supports that view. So we're saying 30-40% of the population would fail this test if that's where you draw the line.
Yeah, it is interesting.
We're not talking about the extremes as much as many people would like to think. In my view, the right to marry, Article 4, 14th Amendment, equal
protection.
Equality under the law. Yeah. Bob's your uncle. There you go. I see no reason that if you're going to have the government endorsing marriage and that means something for taxation and medical benefits and everything else that marriage in the governmental sense leads to.
Right.
I don't see why there would be a problem there. I think that's a nice conservative argument, and I've made it many times to people on the right side of the spectrum, and they have a hard time arguing with that. And you see people with a certain amount of cognitive dissonance suddenly start to think, that may be right. We should get government out of marriage. And yeah, there have been attempts at, I forget what state it was in. It was something southern where they were going to abolish state marriage and somebody was pushing something forward. And it was silly and it was never going to get any traction. But it was a reaction to a valid, modern interpretation. And right now we're, what, 36, 37 states that in some form allow marriage between a man and a woman, a man and a man, a woman and a woman. And it's on an equal basis. Some of them are still in the courts in that 36, right. 37. But we're at two-thirds of the states as it stands right now.
I think my favorite and the most frustrating response to that, you just reminded me, was I came across someone who was arguing, sure, I don't think the government should have any say in marriage. So if there's a bill that says get the government out of marriage, I'll vote on that. But until then, I'm not going to vote for the government to get even more in marriage and say that two men can marry. It's just like, okay, so you're saying that you don't think government should have any say on marriage, but right now, as it is, it's unfair to gay people, but you're not going to do anything to change it because, you know, no reason. That was a very – reminded me of someone I argued with on some various medium.
You but, can get that from a good libertarian argument where why should the government be involved with that kind of personal relationship? I can see that argument. That
but you also have to look at the facts as they stand now. And this is, again, this isn't a gay marriage podcast right now. I mean, we could talk
it's
about
a nice hot button issue to have the debate over, though.
Yeah, but okay. So to try to bring it back, it is a difficult line. And I'm very sympathetic to what you've said on this. I think that you've made some good points so far on you know, it just if 10 years ago, we would have been the opposite side of this issue or whatever, based on popular opinion. But is there a difference between expressing a political or religious opinion like, I don't believe gays should marry? Personally, I don't think anyone should lose their job over saying something like that. I mean, half the country, or like you said, I mean, maybe now it's 40% or whatever the latest numbers are. Lots of people think that. But when you start personalizing and moving toward hatred, what do you think? When it's more, it's not so much, I don't think they should marry, as much as it is, you know, gay people are disgusting, a bunch of personal stuff. Is that, are you still unwilling to say that an A&E or somebody, a hypothetical A&E could ditch someone for that?
Well, can they ditch a vociferous critique of, oh, who's a nice protected group that will offend people if I critique them? Let's talk about Jews.
Because all right, let's.
What could possibly go wrong? Let's say I want to say something nasty about Jewish people. Let's say the pseudo-private police force they have in Williamsburg. Have you ever heard of the Shaarim?
No.
I believe.
No.
It's in certain countries, it's a police force of sorts. It's a patrol. Police. It's a private patrol. It's not an actual security group, but it's people volunteering to patrol the area, watch out for crime. Huh. Something like sort a
neighborhood
of a
watch, but more of an official Jewish one.
It comes from a very Jewish backstory where they.
Well, can you blame them?
there have been problems, but they didn't want to interact with the official police because they were being discriminated against. So they would
taking matters
police
in
their
own.
Their own.
Yeah, okay, sure.
Rather than go to the German police in the 1930s, for example. You know, that would not work out well for them.
Gotcha.
But
okay.
This private organization, they could police some of the things themselves, and this goes back hundreds of years, this sort of thing. In Williamsburg, there are people who have spiffy little official-looking cars with blue lights on the top.
Wow.
And there are a number of leaders in the community who endorse the idea that you call these people first rather than the police, and then they'll bring the police in on their own terms. If it feels they feel it gets too a certain level. There was a case a couple of years ago where a child was abducted and killed, and the police weren't notified until many hours after the Shaorim were notified. Wow. And there have been shootings. And
all right, I'm going to try to...
And just interesting, exciting things. So here I am. I have this very weird aversion to a couple of, in the United States, pseudo police or security forces that have certain jurisdictions, or at least they're imposing a certain amount of jurisdiction into the public sector. I have little tolerance for it. So let's say I'm critiquing them. Am I being anti-Semitic by doing that? And if I am, does my employer at that point, because I'm being harshly critical of a very protected class in the United States, it's hard.
Well, but is critical the I don't know if that's what I was asking, though. I mean, critical versus well, I don't know. Maybe you think that's the same, but critical of a group versus personally insulting of a group. Is there a difference?
Okay. How about this? Continuing on my picking on the Jews, because the moment somebody...
Because you're great at it.
I am... You can just tell I do this day in and day out.
Yeah.
Today, there was a agreement between the New York City administration and the Moyles that operate in New York City regarding certain circumcision practices. And these practices in the past have led to the death of children, led to brain damage. It involved, how do I want to put this without being graphic, oral suction of the blood after a circumcision.
Yeah, a fantastic practice. I can't think of a better... practice.
And it's a very minority practice, even in the believing community. I saw this, and basically the status quo that they have reached is go ahead and continue the practices as you see fit. And if you happen to make a child sick, then we're going to ask you to stop.
Wow, really?
That's the practical upshot of the agreement that was reached today. Before, they were requiring the parents be provided a form to sign agreeing that they are allowing this dangerous procedure to happen, and they don't have to do that now.
Really? Man. Those Jews.
So
that's the point of this, right?
That's the point. So I'm upset. I say something truly nasty about Jews at this point because I see it as a sacrifice, a religious sacrifice of children. We know that over a period of time, children have died. Children will continue to die because of this practice.
Okay.
I get upset and I say horrible, horrible things because I see people dying from this. Is that sufficient reason? Because I can see myself going off on this. When I read this earlier today,
it's hard. It is really hard. I think I definitely want to acknowledge that, like, there's no easy, hard and fast line, I don't think. And maybe your argument is there should be no line. Like, you just, everything is fine. You should deal with it with other words and not with termination, I guess.
Would somebody be able to call me anti-Semitic if I went down a path of criticism?
No, like for me, this may be getting into a separate issue.
You say no, but I can see somebody say
no. I can too. I can too, and I was just about to say I think this is getting into a different issue, and it's a problem we face with Islam as well, where people see any criticism as, you know, anti-Islam, anti-Jewish. It depends on what you're saying. If you say those dirty Jews, look at what they're doing. Yeah, that's. I mean, if you're couching it in language that's personally, you know, that's attacking people's, you know, personal characteristics or whatever it is. If you couch it in that language, yes, I think it can be anti-Semitic. If you go on a bunch of anti-gay rants where, sure, you're your main point is that you don't believe they should be able to marry. That in itself, I don't think can be construed as, you know, awfully homophobic. It's definitely ill-informed, but it may not necessarily be homophobic. You may just have a legal opinion, you know, for whatever reason. But
now
you're
drawing interesting lines because I see activists on both sides saying exactly the opposite.
Oh, me too.
You're being extraordinarily
homophobic. I am not at all saying this is how everyone thinks. I'm giving you my opinion on this. I think this – and what I'm essentially trying to say is I think we're intersecting two issues here. We're bringing another variable into the equation is all I'm trying to say.
The variable is the outside social pressure on, in this case, the company employing
– Well, no. Here, let me say – sorry. I think the variable that I was trying to identify because you're right. That is one we're looking at. Another one I'm trying to identify is – to what degree people associate any sort of criticism of people or ideas and mix those, you know, like to what degree people conflate criticism of ideas with criticism and personal attack of people. That's another element I think we're bringing into this, because what I was the examples I was trying to go with are you're making personal attacks, personal insult, racist, homophobic insults on people, not well-reasoned, you know, critiques of ideas, you know what I mean? I think that's a difference there that I think muddies the waters when we're trying to look at this issue. What do you think?
So it's the difference between having a cup of coffee and then having a rant and having three beers and a whiskey and going off on a rant.
Well, I that's dangerous territory because I don't know. I don't think personally that I ever get into, you know, I'm not trying to be all holier than thou, but I don't ever get in as much as I disagree with a lot of religion, I don't turn it into, you know, like anti-Semitic, what you would think of as typical anti-Semitic language. I never do. I just think like, I can't believe people believe these stupid ideas. But I, you know, I don't know that that's a necessarily, I don't know that that should be a protected thing. Someone's right to turn a criticism of an idea into a like diatribe and a racist rant or something. You know what I mean? Just because they've had a few beers. Is that what do you think?
There comes a point when what you're arguing is somebody has said something too far. And that's
just,
the whole
you're just saying
nub
it's hard
of this
to decide
whole argument.
What's too far.
That's the argument in its totality. There's a line that someone draws based on the content, and on one side of that line, in the circumstances and with the observers that are looking at this line, one step is acceptable, one more step is unacceptable. And that's a very hard line to police. And if you're going to come down deciding where that line goes, I push the line out a lot farther than others.
Yeah, well, yes. And let me just to make sure we're all on the same page, when we're talking state-sponsored, I'm totally 100% with you with that there's no – there. Where I don't want to draw that line. I think hate speech should not be a crime. I really do. I think that's – it's weird that that's a controversial thing, but it seems in Europe that it's maybe worse than here based on – now I had a video I wanted to share, pretty brief, but we're already at like a full episode time. This happens every time.
Why do we always do this?
I know. Now I'm trying to think how to proceed because I really wanted to talk about this. I don't know. We're at time. Should we do a part two? What should we do? What do you think, Michael? You're a listener. Now, I already have something lined up for next week. Otherwise, I would just say part two will be Monday. What do you think? Take your vote.
You could always tease it as Patreon content. Okay. If you want to hear the rest of the argument.
Yeah, but I think everyone should hear the rest. I don't mind doing a certain amount of Patreon content. So let's
– I tried to give you a freebie.
No, I like your idea, except I also have other things I want to be on the main show for us to talk about. But let's rain check. Let's – okay. Here's what we're going to do, fine folks, fine listeners. Sorry, this is a little a little on-the-fly decisions here. We're going to cut off this episode. I'm going to say thank you to my lovely patrons, of which, Michael has been an amazing one. So thank you personally, Michael. Thank you so much for your contribution and help with the show. I really appreciate it.
And always a pleasure.
I will say thank you to my other patrons. I don't want to I don't think I want to go through the process of finding out which Patreon account I'm on, logging off of that one, and then logging on to this one. And so I'm going to cut off the show now. Thank you to patrons. Go to patreon.com/atheist if you want to become a patron and you want to see more content like this. And I will say, tune in on the special bonus content for additional discussion between Michael and I on this very issue. And then I'll say a rain check on a part two. If it fits in next week, maybe we can resume. If not, we'll pick a later date because this is ongoing. So thank you so much, Michael. I'm going to call this episode and say have a great weekend, everyone, and I will see you next week. So thanks, Michael.
You have a great night.